I'm Dani Shapiro, and this is The Way We Live Now. Today is day 64, since we have no idea what day it is. Merry Christmas. Just kidding. And day 22 of this podcast. I've been thinking a lot about the young people whose lives have been put on indefinite pause since the start of the pandemic. Will they be starting college? Going back to college? Will there be jobs for them now or after college? Today, my guest is the president of Wesleyan University, Michael Roth. Michael, thank you so much for joining me to talk about The Way We Live Now.
My pleasure, Dani.
Tell me where you are right now. Describe your surroundings to us.
Well, I'm sitting at a kind of shabby old desk in the president's house at Wesleyan University. Well, my shabby old desk is on the second floor of the house. The first floor is kind of all the public rooms where Wesleyan University has its receptions and its big dinners, and private quarters are upstairs, and the house is from 1830s. And I'm sitting at my desk looking out my window where I see the administrative building and where my office is, and the dean's offices are next door, and I see the campus, which is pretty deserted right now. There are a couple of hundred students here who couldn't get out. They're international students, or because they had nowhere else to go. And so they're taking classes online, living on campus. But the other 3,000 people who are usually here are scattered around the globe.
What would a typical mid-May have looked like out your window?
Well, I would see lots of students outside taking advantage of the warmish weather in New England. It's been a weird spring. And I hear the aluminum baseball bat ping from the baseball field, which is not far from my house. And there would be people running up and down the street in front of the house. And this time of year, there's likely to be a protest. It might not be at this very moment, but spring is the college season protest time, and the protesters are, alas, reduced to Zoom, I guess, in their view. They Zoom bomb, but it's not the same. And other things are the same. I mean, I taught this morning. I'm teaching the last week of classes. And so I'm preparing, this week I'm talking about postmodern architecture to give them a sense of the physical differences between the postmodern and the modern. And they're reading Maggie Nelson and they're reading Richard Rorty. So And I do that in other years, but normally I see them face to face rather than on my computer screen.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, so you're teaching this semester and students everywhere have transitioned to Zoom classes and online learning. What are you seeing? What do you think is what is gained? What is lost? What is it like to be doing that kind of teaching, you know, not physically in the room with all of the five senses and body language? And what's your experience of that?
Well, I had an unusual experience in this regard because I did a class actually several years ago with Coursera, and it's been up and running ever since. So the students can look at the younger Michael Roth teaching some of the same books, you know, in 20-minute bites on Coursera for free. And they could have always done that. And right now, usually a couple of hundred people a week around the world join that class every week for now 5 or 6 years. Now it's 1,000 people a week joining because everyone's at home. Mm-hmm. But my students, typically, I would go to see them in the classroom, and there'd be a lot of banter, and there's I always play some music. I have a playlist for each class, as they come in. And so what I do now is I'm not allergic to the online stuff because I actually found teaching the MOOC extremely interesting, different from being together, but really interesting to have students of very different ages and different countries and, you know, different situations than my typical college students. And so I loved having the MOOC experience. But on Zoom, I see my students who I'm friendly with, you know, or more or less, and there are 50 some odd of them, 52, and it's a big class for Wesleyan. And it feels really odd because I see them in situ, right? They're, some of them are in bed with their coffee. It's morning class here in Connecticut. It's really early in the West Coast. And some of them are, you know, at desks, and some of them are not letting me see where they are. And I still, but I still play the music in the beginning. I still cold call on people. Not as much. I feel a little bit too rude. Just picking on someone and calling their name. But Danny, to my surprise, they respond very willingly. They're writing each week because I have them write on a bulletin board each week, even when they're here and physically. Their writing seems really great. I mean, I don't trust my judgment so much. I mean, it seems to me even better than usual. But I think I'm so hungry for it in a way that I may be colored in my judgment. But I am just super impressed that given all the other things going on in their lives, and some of them have real trouble and they have, they can't get the work in. But for the most part, they seem really engaged. And this morning, last week of classes, you know, it's they're getting to the end. They have all these other things going on. A few of them start asking me about extra credit projects they could do. So I, you know, it's not everybody, of course, and not even a majority, but I'm impressed by their adaptability. They really would prefer to be together, but my attendance on Zoom is probably a little better than it is when they're here. And, you know, as far as I can tell, they, and I do get to read I read everybody's comment now when I'm in this situation every week. They seem really engaged by the material and ask great questions. So I feel more optimistic about it. I know some of my colleagues are more, more melancholy about it than I, but, I'm glad I'm teaching, because I think I would not have predicted this as just abstractly.
It's so interesting. I mean, what you're saying about feeling like their work is stronger, that some of their writing is stronger. I had a conversation a couple weeks ago with my friend, the novelist Ruth Ozeki, who teaches at Smith. Mm-hmm. There's this writing exercise that I've given to my nonfiction memoir students for years that's just based on the Joe Brainard book, I Remember, where I have them begin every sentence with I Remember and just finish the sentence and then line break, write another I Remember, just in an associative way. And Ruth told me that she had kind of amended or added onto the exercise that I always give my students. And she was having her students do a kind of fictional treatment of I Remember, writing from their future self. I remember the time of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And she said it yielded some really extraordinary work, and that made a lot of sense to me. I mean, there's a sharpening that's happening with all of this social isolation, and also something very humanizing in the way that we're all seeing each other. I mean, even if there's a Zoom background, or, you know, there's something very tender and human about seeing, whether it's students or seeing their professors or seeing newscasters and talking heads on nighttime, you know, on the news. We're not exactly in the roles that we usually play.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. And I think there's something just pretty simple about, like, the people aren't taking this for granted.
Yeah.
I mean, so much was taken away from people in this moment. And so, of course, in some cases, horrifically so, family members dying. And I mean, it's just, but the casual contacts that we would normally have, that's been taken away. And so when people do gather, even if it's virtually, or even as spectators, I do think there's a tenderness and an openness that I certainly wouldn't have predicted. I saw a show that the Wesleyan Theater Department put on over the weekend, which I went to because I'm the president and I should go and wave my flag when I at different things. And I said I would go, and I went. It was one of the great theatrical experiences I've ever been witnessed. I mean, it was a Zoom production of a show called The Method Gun. And it was about Stella Adler's method theories and how she imposed them on actors preparing for Streetcar Named Desire by having them go into isolation, digging deep. Now, this was the production they were working on when they were here. And the show, which was live, and it was, the students were all over the world, literally. They were in Singapore and China and around North America. And it was beautiful and moving and intense at times. And I was riveted sitting in my, you know, my little room with the computer on my lap. I was riveted. And I thought, Katie Pearl, who is the director and the professor of this class, she just turned these conditions that created much more focus and digging deep into something that produced a really wonderful work of art. And so, I would never in a million years have thought, well, it's a theater class that's going to shine in this moment. But there it is.
That's such a wonderful and hopeful thing.
Yes.
So let me ask you this. Your interests as a scholar are centered on how people make sense of the past.
Yes.
And I've been feeling so acutely aware that we're all living through a moment in history. It's the only way that I can understand it or place myself within it, or it within my consciousness or understanding. How might we someday make sense of this moment?
It's a great question. I as someone who's worked in this area for a long time, I think that people are so bad at predicting this.
Yeah, that's why I hesitated to ask you.
You know, but it's one of the ways we do begin to remember is by imagining how we will remember. I mean, you've written about these things so beautifully that you begin to see yourself remembering your experience, you know, while the experience is going on. And I think that is heightened in a moment of crisis, in a moment of trauma, in a moment of sometimes of elation. You kind of see yourself having the experience. And I think right now, some people like me who have to plan, you know, what would it mean to have a safe enough opening of the campus in the fall? You know, we're not here. We're thinking, what is the future going to be of this? And some of that is, you know, just efficiency stuff. And some of it is, it's hard to be in this moment without thinking about how it will look to us from the future, because the moment is one of really radical uncertainty. And a lot of people don't like being in a situation of radical uncertainty. So we try to figure out what would make that uncertainty or ambiguity, undecidability, what will make it less troubling. And the way to make it less troubling is to see it as something that's part of your past, right? You know, because there's a future stability from which you imagine yourself looking back. What I'm conscious of now is that I don't want to forget that there's just some people who are not going to have a future from this moment. You know, that we Americans are so focused on imagining a future from which we look back on how we got to be who we will be later. There are, you know, now what is it, 65,000, 70,000 people who won't get to do that, and their children won't have the same, you know. I mean, we're still not even counting our losses.
No, maybe. Yeah.
And so I find even my own responsibilities of having to plan and, you know, organize and budget, there's something obscene is probably too strong a word, but there's something wrong about not paying attention to the losses around us, and just kind of dwelling with that, living with that for a bit. I think we will forget them. I hate to say it. We won't, you know, we will remember those people, that guy who recovered, you know, who fought, we use that word all the time, this illness, who won again, beat Corona, you know. And I think I get it. I understand that. And I participate in it. But, you know, I do want to remember that for nobody's fault, these people who are just unlucky and are not going to make it. And that didn't have to be this way. Right? That it's not just a natural phenomenon. It is a major screw up by a national government that doesn't care about its most vulnerable citizens. I don't want to forget that, because the people who will be there in the future remembering will be the survivors.
Well, in a way, you're saying Like that the people in the future who'll be remembering who are the survivors will also be forgetting.
They'll be forgetting because it's nice to survive.
Mm. Do you think that's just human nature?
I don't know. I mean, it's human nature for some humans.
Mm-hmm.
For the Shapiros, it's not human nature. I mean, there are some people who remember the bad things. Remember, you almost died from that, my mother always says.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm glad for that. I mean, I respect my tradition. I respect this tradition too, because I think there is a tendency to want to be with those who last and those who survive, and not to be lachrymose and dwell only with the mournful. But right now we could still save lives, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. right now there are people still dying, and so I want to make sure we at least pay them our respects.
Yeah,
I had the weird experience a few weeks ago of going to the cemetery with Kari, my wife, because my 94-year-old philosophy teacher from Wesleyan died and was being buried right here. And I happened to be here, and they happened not to kick me out of the cemetery so I could stand there and be with his family a little at distance, but be among them. And it wasn't about COVID. It was about, you know, paying your respects to the pandemic raises the stakes for what it means to pay our respects.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to make sure we do that too, as we plan, as we recover, as we rebuild or reopen, that we don't forget to pay our respects, which the, you know, President Trump does not seem to, that's not his modality.
That's a very important point. And there's so much loss and it's ongoing right now. It's we're in a very fluid state. We're not, we use phrases like when we get to the other side of this, or, quote unquote, the new normal. And I'm not comfortable with any of that language because it reduces it somehow to an incident or something that will be over. So I have one last question for you, probably another impossible question. How do you think the decisions will be made in terms of trying to make choices about reopening or reopening in stages when the situation is still as uncertain and unclear as it is today?
Yeah, it's a great question. And last year I published this book, Safe Enough Spaces, which was really about free speech and political correctness. But now I find myself thinking, what does it mean to have a safe enough university to reopen in the fall? It won't be risk-free. It wasn't risk-free before, of course. But what does it mean for it to be safe enough, to be a place of learning and friendship and, you know, exuberance and wildness at times, all the things one wants at a college and a university campus? And I think the answer is that we have to be able, to test everyone who's on a campus, and more than once. And we have to be able to take care of people who get sick.
Mm-hmm.
And to attract the people with whom they've interacted. That there are two dimensions to that, at least. One is to provide people who do get sick, most of whom, if they're young people, will have fairly mild symptoms, if symptoms they have at all. But we have to be able to give them supportive isolation so that they actually don't go around infecting other people, and they can take their classes online, let's say, while they're recovering and not infect other people. We have to have some basic public health rules in place. And then the other thing we have to do is to make sure, if we're opening, that we can take care of our most vulnerable students, faculty, and staff. And I think especially of the students who are immunocompromised, and many more at Wesleyan. You know, I thought we'd have dozens maybe, and of 3,000 students, and actually it was a few hundred. We see so many news reports about the bozos who are out there yelling at policemen and breaking rules. But, you know, the vast majority of Americans, most of whom would not have suffered greatly had they even gotten ill, they still, suffered the isolation out of a sense of something between solidarity and fear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if the campuses will open, the residential ones like Wesleyan, if we have a sense of solidarity, that people are in this together, as the phrase goes, and also that they have compassion for those who are vulnerable. So when they get sick, we protect them.
Mm.
And I think we could do that. with the appropriate number of tests and the technology for tracing, which I'm very hopeful we'll have by midsummer so that we can plan to open in September.
That is a very, very hopeful note. I just find myself thinking about those students and what they'll be learning from that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's nothing, you know, as my friend Sylvia Borstein, the mindfulness teacher, mm-hmm. often says, it isn't what I wanted, but it's what I got.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a really wonderful conversation. I so appreciate your taking the time and the thoughtfulness. And I hope that September you're hearing the ping of baseball bats again. And
I hope you're right. I hope you're right, Danny. And thank you for including me in your wonderful podcast. And I look forward to listening to this one and to the others.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks so much. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to The Way We Live Now. Tell us the way you're living now. We want to hear. Call us on, you might want to get a pen for this, 909-713-8995. That's 909-713-8995. And record your story, and we might just use it on the pod. Also, you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/The Way We Live Now Pod. We are creating a community here, and we would love for you to join us. You can find me on Instagram at Danny Ryder. The Way We Live Now is a production of iHeartRadio. It's produced by Lowell Brulanti. Beth Ann Macaluso is executive producer. Special thanks to Tristan McNeil and Tyler Klang. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.